Great, thank you. Morning, everybody. I'm Donnie Myers. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to start today kind of to set a tone. And those that would care to join me, if you'd like to close your eyes, and we'll do the third step prayer together. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I will help, of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. Amen. Thank you for that. That helps me and puts me in the right space. I also, whenever I go to a meeting or am asked to speak anywhere, I use Lois's prayer, which is, please let me speak from the language of the heart. And I always loved that. That hit me when I first read that. I thought, okay, that works for me, because I have one intention today, and that is to come from that place. As a man, I'm extremely honored to be a part of this group. I've been coming here for 10 years. I've made it probably 5 times in 10 years. And in saying that, I have this other voice in my head that says, what took you guys so fucking long to get me to the podium? Because there's a part of me that's an incredible narcissistic, megalomaniac, egomaniac, hyperbolic, delusional child that wants everything to revolve around him. So that's why I know I'm among friends. I've listened to your stories all weekend, and it's been an incredible retreat for me. I came here with no agenda. I am flying absolutely without a net today. The only guidance I was given is 10 minutes of drunkalog and 50 minutes of recovery, and try not to use the four-letter words. I'm going to use them today. I hope they don't offend you. I will use them artistically for color. Hopefully they will make impact dramatically where I need them. But I will try and keep them to a minimum, truly, because as you get to know my story, I'm a fucking white trash truck driver from the bush in Alaska, and I grew up in a trailer with mafia. That's where my story starts, was in Denali Park. My father was a bag man for the mob, better known as the Teamsters. Our driveway, I'm not kidding, okay? I know it's funny, but it's real. Our driveway was an airstrip. At any given time, we'd have 6 to 8 planes out there, from Learjets to Little Piper Cups. What I didn't know is he was running guns, drugs, and money up and down to every village in Alaska, and I was his side wingman from about the age of 3 or 4. I had been in every strip joint. I had met every hooker up and down the line by the time I was 10. I could drink like a man by the age of 10. That was important to him. I could walk into any bar or any strip club in any titty parlor in Alaska and get a drink. I carried a .357 for protection, but that was normal up there. This was the 60s, okay? It was still cowboy turf. But that was my norm as a child. So when we talk about love versus sex and all those kinds of things, mine was pretty skewed from the very beginning in how I viewed women. Both of my parents were raging drunks, okay? My mom, until the age of 16 when I left home, I never knew her a day sober. She was passed out on the floor all the time, sloppy drunk, messy drunk. My father was an evil, nasty drunk that did all the terrorist things and used to beat and fuck my little sister and I as children regularly. So there was horrific abuse. And my story ends at the age of 16 when I put a gun to his head. And I had to make a choice whether to kill him or walk out that night. And I walked out that night. I believe that was the first true God moment in my life as a man, because it saved my life. I was cold enough to kill him. I was capable of it. It wasn't a moral, ethical issue. I wanted to do it. Something inside me, as a 16-year-old boy that was that damaged, said, you pull this fucking trigger, and it's going to walk with you the rest of your life. It's going to be a stain on your soul. Now, how I came to that conclusion, I don't know. But that was the first day that I started my recovery. I ended up leaving Alaska, and I was on the streets of Seattle for about 6 or 8 months. After I left home, the secret came out about what my father had been doing. And he was kicked out of the house. He beat my mom so bad, she was in bed for about a month, broken bones, the whole nine yards. And she ended up calling Alcoholics Anonymous, and this was in 1979. Till the day she died a year ago next week, she never had a drink after that. I had left home. I had boogied when she got into sobriety, so I never knew this woman sober. I knew the woman I grew up with. And after months on the streets in Seattle, bouncing around, surviving any way I could, I had come to a point where I was out of options, and I literally, I had two choices to eat. I was either going to turn tricks, or I was going to start armed robbery. Those were good ideas to me, to be able to feed myself as a man. And I took a third option, which was I called my mother for help. And she said, "You can come to my house if you go to an AA meeting with me tonight." And it was a Sunday night, April 14th, 1980, and I went to Fremont Hall. That's where she had gotten sober the year before. And I walked up those stairs in the old hall and, you know, cut through the smoke and sat down with, you know, hookers, pimps, bikers, hardcore people that were my homies. I felt right at home there. And I felt like a badass, and I was still carrying my gun, okay? So I think I'm a tough kid, right? This place scared the shit out of me, you guys. These people were actually tough. You know, I was just a punk kid with a big mouth. And I sat through that meeting, and I can still remember it to this day. I mean, this is 35 years ago, and it's still clear as a bell sitting there in that room, and it was packed on a Sunday night. And I heard somebody mention the word treatment center, and I didn't know what that was. And we left the meeting, and I asked my mom, "What is that?" And she was telling me there's these, you know, spin dry clinics where you go for a month and you get sober. And I thought, what a great idea. I want to do that because I wanted to be off the street and I wanted food in my belly. That was it. And she's like, "Really? You want to go to treatment?" I said, "Absolutely." And I went to treatment at Alcinus. At that time, Jim Milam did not have a program for minors. So they had to interview me to see if they were going to allow me in. They'd never had anybody under the age of 18 in there. In about 5 minutes, they checked me in. Okay. I was hardcore chronic at that stage of my life. And that began my first round of recovery. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell in love with everything about this program because it was a place where I belonged. I finally had a place that I could go. I didn't have anything, ever. And you people were magnificent to me. In 1980, I can count on one hand the number of young people that were sober in Seattle. And we started Eastside Brats, University Young People, Lakeside Young Peoples, PSYPC. All these things have been going for years and years now, and they started in 1980. I was part of that original Brat Pack crew that started all these meetings together, and it was really exciting for us. If we heard that a kid in Yakima wanted to get sober, we'd go to Yakima and go pick him up and bring him to town and take him to, you know, our meetings. We had young people's meetings. And, you know, we took a lot of shit from old-timers because we were so young and petulant about who and what we were at that time. But it was an exciting time in Alcoholics Anonymous for us. And I say that because very quickly, over the course of about 5, 6, 7 years, I became kind of a celebrity rock star kid in my own mind in AA. I started getting asked to speak at big conferences. And I would go around, and I was an anomaly. By the time I'm 25, I'm 10 years sober, right? This was unheard of at that time. I'd been sponsoring myself for years. And I loved my sponsor at that point, you know. He was giving me great advice, okay? And at the same time, in my career had absolutely taken off and skyrocketed. I'm a 25-year-old kid. I became a hairdresser and ended up owning the top salon in Seattle by the time I was 21. And I'm on everybody's frickin' Learjet flying around, doing everybody's hair everywhere, and I'm all that in a bag of chips. So by the time I'm 25, I'm living in a penthouse downtown, driving an Italian sports car, wearing Armani suits. This is trailer trash that never went to high school, okay? This is about 1988 by then. And I'm in Paris doing work, and I decide it's time to drink. I'm well now. I'm well. I got it all. And I was sitting in meetings, and I'd look at you guys, and you guys are fucked up. You're broken. You're struggling. Blah, blah, blah. I've got everything I ever wanted and so much more, right? And I'll never forget, I go to a dinner party. I bring a bottle of wine. These people don't know me as recovery guy. And I have a glass of wine. And it's genteel. It's perfect. Tastes good. Great. Have a beautiful night with these people. I go back, and I'm like, wow, I did it. There's no lightning bolts. I can drink again, right? I'm okay. And in the course of the next 3 days while I was there, I made the decision to quit my job, sell the salon, and move to Europe, move to Amsterdam. Okay? Because I want to grow my hair long and play guitar and be a rock star now. That's what I decided to do. This is over a glass of wine in my own head. Talk about insanity. Okay? And I'm not shitting you. And this all seemed to make sense. Like I was listening to Jerry yesterday talk about, you know, planning the death of, you know, he's going to write a bad check, fly to Cincinnati, kill the woman, get the kid, come back. And it all made sense. I'm like, yeah, I'm that exact same guy. I know how that kind of stuff works. Right? In sobriety. Trust me. So I start drinking again, and this will wrap it up. Okay, here's the end of the 10 minutes. I spent 17 years out there. I made an absolute fortune, millions and millions of dollars, and lost it all. And crapped out to the point where my lights got turned off and my water got turned off. And I hadn't made my child support payments in years, and I had several divorces and wrecked several businesses, and I was close to death at 42, 10 years ago. Okay? That was the end for me. And it wasn't a great gunslinging ending, right? Butch Cassidy, I wanted to go out blazing too. This was a whimper. This was no coals left on the fire. It just smelled like piss. Okay? I was dying, you guys. So we all know that piece. And I go to Sunday morning, Lake Forest Park, Third Place Books. And I walk in about 15 minutes before the meeting, and there's one guy there setting up. I always forgot. It had been so long since I'd been in AA. Oh, and by the way, I want to premise this with my mom's about 25 years sober now. And I had a little sister that got sober that had about 23 years in my family. And whenever they would speak at big events, they would invite me to come. I loved going to big events. The Green Lake Thanksgiving, my sister always spoke at because she got sober at Green Lake with Toby and all those whack jobs, right? And these people saved her life, and she would speak every year. And I loved going for one reason, because when they would say, are there any guests or visitors that are non-alcoholic, I would stand up. Everybody in that room knew me as a sober guy that went out. But here I am out there for 10 years, and I'm looking fine in my suit, and I'm all shaved and clean. I'm trying to hold it up. I don't have a problem, right? And I did that for years. Years, because I wasn't like you guys. So me walking back into Third Place Books was not easy. I also thought I was unique when I did that, that nobody had a story like me. Shit, people do this every day, you know? And I remember sitting there, and they asked me, the guy that was setting up was a secretary and didn't know that it was my first meeting. I didn't say anything. He said, would you read how it works? And I said, of course I will. I couldn't get through it. I started bawling. I mean, I lost it. And I was not a crier. I had quit crying years before that. And just the memory of how it works. What got me back to that first meeting is my best friend in the last several years was a gunslinging rock and roll manager out of L.A. He and I would do all kinds of deviant things together constantly. And we were running buddies. And about 2 months before I walked into my first meeting, he had gotten a DWI in L.A. and had to go to AA meetings. And he was getting sober. He had about 60 days. And we were on the phone one day, and I finally told him, and he's like, Donnie, you got to get sober too. You know, you can't do this anymore. And I confessed to him that I'd been in AA as a kid for 10 years. And he was putting on a thing called Coachella down in the desert. And he said, you know, fly down for this, and we'll go get my 90-day chip together next month. Now, I didn't have a nickel left. I was out. He said, you know, I'll fly you down. Call me tomorrow. We'll get this taken care of. So I call him the next morning, and his brother answers the phone. I don't know his brother. And he said, Charlie died, OD'd in the middle of the night. And that was the first game changer for me, because I knew I was next. He was shooting Oxycontin and did a little too much. But he wasn't drinking, right? He wasn't drinking. So that was okay. And I spent a month, I just let it all fall at that point, and I spent a month in my pajamas. I pulled the curtains down, I didn't answer the phone, and I just drank like a fish. And I got a letter from my mom, who lived over in Port Townsend. I don't think she'd ever written me a letter in her life. You know, she'd come see me or call, and I get this letter, and all it says is, your life is unmanageable. Do you think it might have something to do with alcohol and drugs? You know, she was a black belt Al-Anon also, you guys. And I immediately pick up the phone and call her. I'm drunk. Mom, I'm sorry. I love you. I'm going to quit tonight. Right? Nothing happened for the next month. I hung up and forgot about it. Finally, a month later, I walk in. And I walk in on the day of her birthday. Now, talk about manipulation as an alcoholic. I picked that day to get sober for a reason. I was out of dough. I'd never hit my mom up for money in my life. And I thought if I got sober on June 12th, on her birthday, she'd be so honored and moved by that, she'd give me some cash because I need to get out of some trouble. I'm serious. So that Sunday morning, and we were having a party for her that afternoon. So I run over to Port Townsend, my first day sober. Mom, I'm sober. I went to a meeting this morning. Can I have 10 grand? I was insulted that she didn't write me a check right then. I was furious. I left the party pissed off. But I didn't drink. Because I knew it was over, guys. I really did. Having had the experience of being sober young, I knew this program worked. And I took to this like a very desperate man. Okay? I started going to 3 meetings a day. For several reasons. One, I couldn't stay sober for a day, so I had to sit my ass in meetings constantly. Two, I didn't have a job or anything else to do, and my phone had quit ringing a long time ago. I had no friends. I was broke, I was lonely, I was desperate. AA was the only place I felt okay for an hour slice at a time. So I became a meeting junkie immediately and started going to meetings. And in the first week, I met a guy that spoke here a few years ago, Zach H. You guys all know Zach. And Zach comes up to me, and I actually knew him as an actor around town at one point. You know, oh, I didn't know you were an AA guy, blah, blah, blah. And he invites me over that night to watch basketball. I'm about 7 days sober. And I go to his house, and I love this man, so I'm not doing this degradingly at all. This is where I was at this point in my life. But he lived in a tiny little studio with a bed and a TV and a little couch and a little George Foreman grill. And I'm like, man, this guy's a fucking loser. That's the first thing I'm thinking. I'm like, what am I doing? Why didn't he come to my house? I still at least have a flat screen, right? You know? I'm missing the whole point, but this is where I'm at. Right? And I feel sorry for this guy. I knew nothing of his story in AA. And he wants to fix me some dinner, and I'm like, no thanks. No, I'll wait. I'll eat when I get home. And I start watching the game. He starts talking to me about our program. And I'm kind of pushing him off. I'm starting to get irritated. Dude, I'm watching the game. You know, I'm here to watch the basketball game. I don't need to talk about AA right now. We'll talk about AA later. By about the end of the fourth quarter, I am laying on his couch bawling like a baby. He got to me. And he broke in. For the first time, a man broke in with me, and I heard something that I needed to hear. And I said, would you be my sponsor? And he said, yeah. He said, but I want you to make two agreements with me tonight. He goes, I will take you through the book exactly like my sponsor took me through the book. And when we're done, you will spend the rest of your fucking life doing that for every person that ever asks you to do it. Are you ready to do the work? Okay? 10 years later, that's exactly what I say to every single person I work with. I'm going to take you through the book. We're going to do this work together. And when I'm done, you have to promise me that you're going to do this work with every single person that ever asks you to do this work. Are you ready to do the work? That's how we do this, guys. You guys all know this. Okay? So I started that journey, and that's step one for me. I didn't do 90 meetings in 90 days. I did 200 or 300 easily. I mean, I was clocking at least three. I loved weekends because I could get a five-bagger. On a Saturday and Sunday, I could do a 7 o'clock, a 10 o'clock, a nooner, a 4 o'clock, and an 8 o'clock. Okay, I could crank five. And that's what I did that first year. When I think about the first step, and this is very poignant to where we're at today with this, because I've thought about this all weekend. My primary purpose is to stay sober, period, and to help the alcoholic who's still suffering. I want to talk about the alcoholic who's still suffering because there are men in this room that want to fucking die today. Okay? That are either going bankrupt, that are having extremely covert behaviors that are about to get arrested over. Okay? They're one shot from a bullet hole in their head or a drink. I know because I've been that guy in this room and tried to hold it up for the weekend. While the rest of you guys that have spectacular programs, I just sat and, you know, dying. So I'm talking directly to you today, okay? Because we do this together. I don't get out of here unless you do. You know, I'm really clear about all that. That's step one to me. And what's beautiful about that today is that that's what I know. That's my program doesn't get any bigger than that piece. You know, every guy in this room is my sponsor in a way, okay? You really are. That's when I'm accessible, I learn with you, through you, as me, okay? I ran into Jim Sanders at 4:30 this morning in his underwear in the hallway, and he goes like this, and it made me just, my heart open. This means namaste, and in Sanskrit, what it really means is the God in me sees the God in you, okay? That's why we're here. That's why I'm here. You know, we did a spiritual practice meeting last night, and I posed to all of us, what if all of this is spiritual practice? See, I thought my spiritual practice was just my time on the meditation cushion, okay, in my prayer, in my service work. But what if all of this is? If God is everything or nothing, my choice is that God is everything for me. And what I'm learning, and this is where I start to work into step two and three, is that it enhances my life. I'm an extremely pragmatic man. If it doesn't fucking work, I don't want anything to do with it. It's bullshit for me. If my sobriety was not great, I would not be sober today. Period. It has to work. And what my experience has been in doing this work is that it's been this very, very, very slow progression that will never end. Okay? It's unlimited. It's infinite in what we can learn about ourselves, what we can discover about each other, how much love, how good can we stand it? Okay, that's become my mantra as a human being in this program. That's the gift that you guys have given me. When I got sober, my big secret was not that I was a drunk and a drug addict. I knew that. I was clear about that from the age of 16. But my real secret was that I was absolutely insane. Okay, that scared me more than my alcoholism. Because what was going on up here was crazy town. And I had seen it get worse and worse over the decades. And I knew that I was, you know, a few marbles short. And I was scared of that, and I was ashamed of that. And I realized when I looked at the steps on the wall that you guys were too. And that helped save my life. Okay? That's step two to me today. That has never gone away. The only thing that has changed for me in the 10 years of sobriety with step two is that I've discovered more and more the nuance and the depth of my insanity and how rigorous my program must be in order just to stand here and be at neutral. You know? Because I go to crazy town real quick on everything all the time. Ideal, we were talking earlier that I deal every single day of my life with tremendous amounts of anger and rage, pride and ego, and lust. Every day of my life. And guess what? That means I'm a man, is what I've discovered over the years. Welcome to the party, gentlemen. Right? That's where I got to finally. I thought I was going to change all that it would be different. But what's happened for me in my experience is there's an awareness that happens. There's a healing that starts to happen in telling the truth, in living in the truth, and then I can start to make different choices. That's the key. So I had to first get honest about being insane. And then I came to a decision, right? What threw me with step three for a long time, as we understand him. I don't have a clue. I don't. But it took me years to get to that. I thought I had to understand, and I'd always been a seeker. I was a tripper. You know, I loved peyote and mescaline and acid and mushroom, anything that would blow me off into the fourth dimension and be God, you know, and connect to the universe. So I was a big-time space tripper for a long time, and I just always couched it as I'm looking for God. I was always looking for God, and I thought I found it all the time. I was finding it everywhere, right? But it wasn't sticking at all, and I never could understand it. And so I get to step three, and let me back up just one little bit, because he was very clear in his instructions. The first thing we do is we read the book cover to cover, which I'd never done. That was my first assignment with my new sponsor. So I read it cover to cover, every page. And then I went to him, and we sat down. He said, okay, now I want you to read all the way up to We Agnostics, everything. And I want you to get a yellow highlighter pen and highlight everything that has to do with you that you can relate with. So I did that. It took me a few weeks to do that. And then he and I sat down, and we went through that together. And he pulled out his book with all of his highlighting. And we talked about all of that stuff. And then we looked at my insanity. And we started discussing the, you know, opportunity to have a power greater than myself in my life. And he had me do an interesting exercise that I do sometimes with sponsees and sometimes I don't. If people don't have a clear understanding, is he had me write what I thought God was and what I thought God wasn't. And that was a place to start. It was a really hard exercise. And that's how I started looking at step three, because I had to come up with my own definition of what a power greater than myself was. But nothing was really working. I know there's something, but I didn't know what it is. And then finally, it hit me, actually. I was at service at the Center for Spiritual Living. And on the back wall, there's a very simple statement that just said, God is love. I can go with that. I'm actually okay with that. All of a sudden, there was this trigger that went off, and I'm like, oh, okay, this could be something I start to work with. And it would get it out of my head in thinking or understanding what this stuff is and into my heart as an activity or an action. And this is where it gets good. There's that quote that faith without works is dead. I love that because faith to me is a verb, and it's an action. It's a practice. You don't just have faith. None of us know how to have faith. You work with it. You work as if I have the faith of God. What would that be like? That's what I started playing with, and things started to open up for me from then in my consciousness around that. Okay? I will never be done, by the way. I'm gonna throw in a little caveat as I work through the steps. Every step to me is just as important as every other step to me today. I will never be done with any of them. The first time I went through the steps, I thought I was checking them off, getting the box, because I was in a hurry to have a spiritual awakening. I was in a hurry to be a guru in AA, get back to where I was when I was a kid. You know, I was going to be back on the speaker circuit in a year or two. You know, that was my pea brain, right? You guys wanted what I had. you know? It's ridiculous. It really is, and I love it. I absolutely love. I can be very self-deprecating today because it just feels good to relate. We all have this stuff, right? So then I get to step four. And I'm not going to make a big deal out of step four other than the fact that I actually did not have a lot of resentments. I was a nasty, cold mofo. Can I use those four letters? Mofo. I didn't hate you. I got you back. I kept score. I was cold. Revenge is best served later. Okay. I was an expert at taking you out. I was a dirty pirate that would make you the life of the party, and then I'd cut your throat, fuck your girlfriend, take your money, and steal your car. Okay? And those were the guys I hung out with. Those were the good guys. And I'm not kidding. So I really, you know, I had a saying in the bars that it's so much easier to apologize than ask permission. I was a bull in a china shop with everything and anything I ever wanted to do. I just did whatever I wanted. You know, that's psychopathic. And you can see where that comes from in the trail, right? So when I got to four, the key components I missed. The first piece of four is the fourth column to me. What is my role in all of this? Okay, that was a game changer because I became responsible for my actions for the first time. Even for that nasty childhood, right? I could drink over that the rest of my life. You guys could feel sorry for me and, you know, well, no wonder he's twisted. Look what he came from. He didn't have a shot. You know, I could play that card, the white, poor white trash cracker, all I wanted. And it always worked. Especially the more I ascended in social economic power, right? People found that to be an anomaly, that this guy had no education. How the fuck did you get here to our party, right? So I used it as a weapon and in a way to manipulate people all the time. But what I finally had to look at was what was my role in all this, and I had a big role, obviously, in all of it, and still do today, and I'm so grateful for that. But the two pieces that I find today when I'm working with someone that are the most important to me are the sexual ideals and the fear list. You know, we do the inventory, but to me, there's two other sections in there. And those became the most critical pieces, and those come later in the story, because the first few years, I was really trying to stay away from women in Alcoholics Anonymous when I came back. One, not like they were banging down my door anyway, because they weren't. But the first time around as a kid, I only went to meetings to fuck young new girls. Okay, I'm a 25-year-old kid with 10 years, so I'm like this guru kid running these meetings, and I was looking for 19-year-old limping gazelle on the savannah. That was my sobriety for me and my buddies in AA, and I'm not shitting you. And we all know those guys today, right? There are still, we're men. I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying that was my headspace. No wonder I started drinking again, right? I had no program. So when I came back this time, I was very conscious of that, and I wasn't ever going to do that. So that left me nothing really but street hookers. And I remember, and I had done my time with hookers. You know, I grew up in whorehouses, so this isn't anything earth-shattering to me. But this is what was earth-shattering about it. I'm about 90 days sober, and I decided to quit hookers when I got sober. And I'm 90 days, and I can't fucking take it anymore. And I leave my meeting, and I'm driving down Aurora one night looking for something. And I call my sponsor, and it's late. It's like 1 a.m. I've been driving for 45 minutes to an hour manically from downtown up north looking for something that isn't a cop. And I'm 90 days sober, and I call Zach. It's 1 a.m. He's like, you know, you okay? And I said, yeah, I'm fine. He goes, you going to drink? I said, no, I'm not going to drink. He goes, why are you calling me? And I said, dude, I'm running down Aurora trying to get a blowjob. And he goes, so? Why are you calling me? See, I had all this garbage, all this guilt, all this remorse. I'm a bad, horrible, terrible man. I'm the scum of the earth for doing it. He didn't give a fuck. He's like, don't call me with that shit. If you want a drink, I'll talk to you. He says, don't get drunk. Go get a blowjob and go to bed. Hangs up the phone. Okay? Game changer. That was a game changer for me. This was the beginning of my sexual healing. Okay? I had never shared that with anybody. And he didn't even care. He was annoyed that I called him because I wasn't in trouble. You know, I woke the guy up. So, step five was a lot harder than I thought it would be. I thought I was up for that. And he sat and listened to my fifth step and listened to this stuff, because I got to tell you, when I can talk about my childhood the way I do today, 10 years later, this is years and years of intense program, intense therapy, including antidepressants, and I'll get to that in a little bit, okay? 4 years of theological divinity school where you get grinded down. You know, I loved the last speaker when he held up his inventory thing, and if you're an AA and you haven't done that, I thought, yeah, I went through divinity school. I had to put it all out on the table. Because you have to be transparent. The truth does set us free, gentlemen. You know, that's not just a hokey cliche. That's been my experience. But I couldn't get to the truth for a long time because there was so much shame built around my hiding my secrets. And we are only as sick as our secrets, right? And you guys taught me to bring those out. So five was really hard, and at the end of five, I remember being so absolutely shocked that he wasn't blown away by it at all. You know, it was almost like calling him about the hooker the year before. He's like, yeah, whatever, great. Now I want you to sit quietly for an hour, and I want you to read this little paragraph and go over the first four propositions and be quiet for an hour. And I did that, and I felt peace. He left my house, and I just sat there. And I hadn't sat quietly without a doobie or a glass of gin and felt that calm in decades. So something happened with that that was very real to me. Because I shared, that's the power of sharing with somebody else, that can be non-judgmental and compassionate. And what I realized is that I wasn't the monster that I grew up with. You know, I had some issues with my dad. And I realized that I hadn't brought all that on at that point. Six and seven, we kind of blew through, like duck pate through a Frenchman. It's two paragraphs. It's easy, right? You just do the prayer. So I started doing the prayer. I do the prayer every day of my life today with intention and meaning. It's part of my daily spiritual practice. I say it out loud. The first thing I do when I get up in the morning is before my feet hit the floor, I say, good morning, God. And that's how I start my day and start my dialogue with my power, my love, and my life. And then I do the third step prayer, and then I do the seventh step prayer. And the meaning of it has evolved so greatly over the years. Because I asked for my defects to be removed that stand in the way of my usefulness. It doesn't mean I'm rendered white as snow. It doesn't mean I'm going to be perfect. My ego would love me to walk on water and show you guys how I levitate today. I would love to do that for you, and I can't. But my head says that in enlightenment and self-mastery, there is a place that I'll be able to do that. That's part of the whack job, delusional perspective I have on spirituality. So I whip through those two paragraphs and move straight to step eight. And wasn't getting anything out of six and seven at the time, but didn't care. I did them. So now let's do the amends, because I want the promises. I took a screeching halt at step eight. You know, in the book it says that we did our list when we did our four step. But as I said, my four step list actually for resentments wasn't that big, because I always kept score and got you back and I won. So there were a lot of people that I torched. And my eighth step was daunting. And I drug it on for months and months. And I was scared shitless. Because I wasn't doing step eight, actually. I was afraid of step nine. And there was no way I was going to be able to get through this list. Ever. I knew that. It involved a lot. And my sponsor just kept saying to me, just fucking make a list. You're not on step nine. Knock it off. You know, knock it off. Just make your list. So finally, I do my list. And we sit down. And I have a huge relief because we go through my list. And we make three different columns. We make the amends I'm going to make now. And then the amends I'm going to make later. and then the amends I'm never going to be allowed to go near. And I didn't even know that. I hadn't read ahead, you know, in the 12 and 12 yet. I didn't know he was going to pull that. So I was hugely relieved because 3/4 of my list was over in the other two columns. So we had knocked out 75% right up front. So I actually was thrilled at that piece of it. And I started working through the amends process. I'm doing this at hyper light speed. I'm only 6-7 months sober. Okay. And his mantra to me constantly was, would you just slow down? And I'm like, no, fuck no. I want to get this shit done. I want a spiritual awakening and I want to move on. Okay. It doesn't work that way, but it's fine. I didn't know that. And he just kept right with me, kept pitching me balls to hit. So I start doing the ninth step. And the first thing I want to do is I want to go to every woman I've ever been with. Okay, to show them how wrong they were to having left me. Let them know how well I'm doing now, right? Let them know that I still love and care about them and how magnanimous I am as a man. Fuck, I am so fucking fucked up and broken, okay? And he's like, it ain't gonna happen. But I picked one. I didn't tell him. I picked one. She was my favorite. She was the hottest F I ever had, okay? So I gotta go see her. Okay, so I go, she lived in this condo on Capitol Hill with a security building, and I waited for somebody to leave so I could sneak in and go knock on her door. I'm serious, because I knew she wouldn't buzz me in. I'm like 7-8 months sober, okay, flying without a net. And I knock on her door, and she comes to the door, and I'll never forget the face of terror, right? Why wouldn't you? You know, here's this psycho, you know, stalking me 10 years later. And she and I had had a couple of abortions together. We had had some real train wrecks over the years. And she just looks at me in terror and slams the door. I'm like, hey, wait a minute. I just want to talk to you. Get the fuck away from my door now. And I was appalled by that. What's happened to her? And I walk out and my phone rings literally 5 minutes later, Seattle Police Department. Yeah. And she had just called them. And they were on their way to her house right then. And I'm talking to this guy. I'm like, wait a minute. Actually, no, I just came to apologize to this woman. He stops and he goes, are you an Alcoholics Anonymous? This guy was sober. I still don't know who he is to this day. I said, yeah, actually I am. I'm doing my night. He goes, listen, let me give you some advice. Leave her alone. Do not ever contact her again. Got it? Got it. Thank you, sir. I get to 10. 10's easy, I think, in my own head. You know, daily inventory, admit when we're wrong. I'm getting good at cleaning house now. You know, at that point, I'm thinking it. You know, with my first amends didn't go so well, but they start coming along. And the interesting thing is I can honestly say 10 years later, every person on all three columns is done. Thank you to a power greater than myself in this program and you men. I have walked through so much shit. I have paid so many bills, so many amends of spiritual quan that I've had to lay on the table and say I was wrong. I never got a chance to apologize to any one of them. I wasn't given that right when I made my amends. It was very clear to say I was wrong. How do I make this right? And I let you dictate terms. I had one woman that had lived with me for months. I took care of her when she had a busted back. And she ended up paying my rent and child support for about 3 months because I was so screwed up. I was just drinking and drugging it away. And she wanted me to pay it back. And it was a large bill, you know, I think $15,000, $20,000. I didn't have shit when I got sober. I didn't have any money. So you're going to pay this back. And she goes, and you're going to pay me 20% interest on my money. I screamed and yelled for about 30 minutes to my sponsor, you know. I paid 20% on that money because that was what was needed. It took years to pay that off. I get to 11. I'm 7 months sober. And this is my territory. I'm a spiritual bastion of health, gentlemen. I got to tell you that. At 7 months, I had been, praying and meditating for years. I was a wake and bake yoga guy where I'd get really high and go to yoga class every day and stand on my head and chant ohms. And so I thought I had all of it. And I get to 11 and I get a phone call. I will shit you not. I'm walking out of a third step meeting and it's 8 o'clock in the morning. And this guy calls me from India that I knew kind of peripherally that lived in an ashram. And he said, listen, I just had this vision of you here at the ashram with the yogis meditating. You need to come hang with us. Great, I'd love to do that. And they sent me a ticket. So I spend a couple months in India. This is my 11th step story. I'm excited. I'm telling this at meetings. I'm going to India. This is my big breakthrough. I've been waiting to be invited for all these years. It's about time they called me up, It was normal for me, right? I had expected it. So I go to India, and I spend 2 months in this ashram. Really, really heavy spiritual practice. 10 hours a day of meditation. It's hard. It's not pleasant. It was actually one of the most miserable things I've ever done in my life. Truth be told. Cool story later, right? It's great. People perceive you differently. But it was really hard, really miserable. I did not get anything out of it. I came home and I was exactly the same guy that had left, and I was pissed by that. Totally furious because I was going to get God this time. This was going to be the answer. What I got, though, is that I finally didn't care about what God was. Something shifted for me because I had gone to the extreme of going and sitting with all the enlightened yogis where I was going to get the transmission and it still didn't happen, so I don't have a clue. I finally gave up, and that's when things started to shift for me. That's when things really started to change. Now, I believe that as we understand him in our literature is only a caveat to give us permission to believe anything we want. It actually isn't the literal meaning as we understand him that we're supposed to frickin' understand him. That's where I missed the point of that. Okay? And I'm not saying you can't. I honor anybody that has a definition. I love anybody that has a clear, defined faith in religion. I think that's incredibly admirable. I have never found that. It's never worked for me personally. So I make it clear that I'm in a spiritual realm of learning on a daily basis, And it's the garden variety, It's just God is love. That's all I got for you. And it works. I get to 12. And I'm sitting with my sponsor having lunch, celebrating now that we're on page 164. And I'm going to start doing the last two paragraphs. And I'm going to ask if I can be of service to other alcoholics now, because that's what we do, right? We've cleaned house. We've gotten our own house in order, and we're going to go do this stuff. And I'll be damned, but like three guys asked me to sponsor them that week. That was surreal to me. I didn't raise my hand. I didn't say anything different. I just started doing page 164. I'm like, wow, this works. But I had a secret, and that was I hadn't had a spiritual awakening. I'd done all the steps. And I sat down with my sponsor. I said, what's that all about? And he says, well, let me give you my definition. Maybe this will work for you. He said, by then I'm like 18 months sober. He says, you're sober 18 months now. You're awake. You're stark raving sober, which was true. He said, you are actually trying to live your life now by spiritual principles. He goes, it's really that simple. That's what a spiritual awakening is. And for the last 8.5 years, that has been my experience, okay? That's all this is. I had chased the carrot of enlightenment for decades. I wanted self-mastery. I wanted to evolve. I wanted to leave this fucking plane for all the right reasons because I hated myself and hated what was going on around me. So I'd do anything to escape. And spirituality was part of that. But what I realized is I'm stuck here. I'm a human being. And I need to learn this first. Because I ain't going anywhere right now, but here. And it became about being for the first time and paying attention to that. I met a really hot girl at that point at the center, smoking hot. And she wanted to be a minister, and she wanted to go through ministerial school and divinity and training. So guess what I did? I went to school. I wanted to get laid by God, right? I thought she was my God. We all know that. And we moved in together, and we started divinity training together. And after about a year of that, it wasn't working for me at all. It was just another fraud. I was trying to look good. The irony is she and I broke up. She quit divinity school and I kept going because I was actually getting something out of it. I was starting to grow in a way that was very conducive to my AA program. And it was really beautiful to me what was starting to happen to me in my life. Extraordinary things in my evolution started happening. The first big piece for me is just the awareness that at 2 years sober, I was more miserable than when I had gotten sober. And that's when I hit the dark stuff. I was really depressed. I was secretarying two meetings. I had half a dozen sponsees. I was going to at least 7 meetings a week. And I was inside, I was dying. And what I realized is that I hated my own guts. And I sat down with my sponsor and I told him that. I said, I need to do another inventory just on me, because I really hate me. It had taken me a couple years just to get to that piece of the lie, right? And quit making a woman my higher power. And he said, you know, I think it's time for therapy for you. So I went into therapy. And the therapist, I sat down with her. The very first session, I said, I want two things out of the work we do. I want to learn to love myself, and I want to learn to be right-sized as a human being, because I don't know either of those at all. So we started doing that work. And within the first 6 months, she forced me onto antidepressants by saying, listen, I'm either going to check you into suicide watch, or you need to try this because you are clinically depressed and you don't even know it. You're catatonically dead inside right now, and you have so much anger and rage, you're going to kill yourself or somebody else. You're dangerous. And I'm like, really? I'm okay. I'm fine. She was right. She's absolutely right. So that's why I talk about this, and I think about this wherever I go, because there is a man here that knows exactly what I'm saying that's in the middle of this right now, and you're not alone. You're absolutely not alone. Lean into this stuff. I want to talk about where I'm at today with my program, because a year ago I came here. My mom was on her deathbed. She was 35 years sober, and she had given me her coin, and Sunday morning I passed her 35-year coin around to you guys. And about 5 minutes before Jeff got up to speak, I got a text from her saying, get to me now. And I took off out of here and drove over to her place in Tacoma. And I took care of her and I walked her home. That's what she wanted. She wanted me to be with her while she died. And the interesting piece about all of this is that you guys carried me there. I shared the story with her when I got there with her coin and said, every man in that room, put love into this. And I can walk you home now. To go from that boy in the trailer to having the honor and privilege of walking this woman home is one of the greatest things I've ever done as a man. The last few years of our lives together as mother and son were so incredibly deep and rich and real, and peace had been made. The same thing happened to my father. When I was 4 years sober, the way I was going to make amends to that bastard was to go to the Monroe State Penitentiary and work with the men in the Special Offenders Unit, the same guys. That's where my father had been for 15 years. And I knew if I could go in there and do AA and love those men, that I'd be okay. And that's what I did. Okay? That's what I had to do in my program to forgive him and forgive me. So there's grace that happens. Now, that couldn't have happened the day I got here. It took years to get to that. But you guys have walked me into that place. You know, there's a place that we all stand today just as humans, just as men. Right? No better and no worse. That's what I'm seeing is right-sized. There's so much wisdom in this room. There's so much sobriety in this room. And what I've learned to do is just to lean into it and trust it and just be a part of it. That's what you guys teach me on a daily basis. I think I work my program more rigorously now than I did when I came in 10 years ago, and that's ironic to me. I thought I'd slack off over the years. It seems to just heat up more and more. you know, this is my life. This is all I got. Everything else comes because of this. You know, my primary purpose is to stay sober and help the alcoholic who still suffers. Thank you. And I swore I wouldn't hit the podium. Thank you.
Guys, one